This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, in for Jen White. American businesses are in crisis as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, and higher education is no exception. Campuses that didn't reopen risk losing students to colleges that did. Lawsuits and petitions from students demand lower tuition for online classes. And no students means no money from housing, dining, bookstores, and other campus services. But even before the pandemic, college seemed to be losing its appeal. In a 2018 survey by the Pew Research Center, 61% of Americans said they believe higher education is headed in the wrong direction. On today's show, we ask, can colleges survive the financial hit from COVID-19? And can they make the case to students and parents that they really are essential? My guests are Frederick Lawrence. He's the secretary and CEO of the Phi Beta Kappa Society and a distinguished lecturer at the Georgetown Law Center. He previously served as president of Brandeis University. Frederick, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you today.
Also with us is Brian Alexander, an education futurist and author of Academia Next, The Futures of Higher Education. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here. Thank you for hosting us.
And Lila Burke is a general assignment reporter at Inside Higher Ed. Lila, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
Can you kick us off, Lila, with an update on how campuses are doing with these reopenings? Are there any colleges that you can point to that are doing a good job of keeping their COVID-19 rates down?
Sure. Well, I would say that, colleges on the whole, there are colleges that are, have gone fully online for the fall semester. There are colleges that are doing fully in person with their classes. That's sort of a minority. Right. And then there's a lot of colleges that are doing classes where you'll have one part of it online, you'll have other parts of it in person. And as far as the colleges that have invited students back, to live in residence halls, to take at least some of their classes in person, it's clear that some of them are struggling to make this work and others are doing a little bit better. So a lot of the high case numbers that we're seeing have been at very large universities, and those are the ones with, sort of the scary numbers. So, University of Georgia has had, over 2,000 cases in the last 4 weeks. University of Alabama has had, nearly 2,000. And then you have some smaller colleges where the case numbers are a lot lower. Vassar, I believe, has had only 22 cases. And so places like that at University of Pittsburgh is kind of large and has limited cases because they've been doing only online instruction. It's sort of hard to compare apples and oranges just because, right. Some of these colleges are very large and some are very small. What really matters is how a university is able to also handle those cases when they have them. Are they providing quarantine housing? Are they giving students meals in that quarantine housing and things like that? And that is all over the board.
I want to turn to you, Brian, because your book, Academia Next, examines how current trends are going to transform American higher education over the course of the next 20 years or so. You released it back in January of this year, but you actually wrote in the book about the possibility of a pandemic. Are you a wizard?
I have a beard like one. but I think this is something that is well known within the futures community. Mm-hmm. We've been looking at the possibility of epidemics and pandemics for more than 40 years. We've been doing research, consulting, publishing documents, holding simulation games. And this is one case where we got it right, unfortunately. So I wrote that passage in around 2018 or so, based on all this futures tradition. So on page 23 of Academia Next, you get this thought experiment. What happens if a pandemic, say the scale of the 1918 Great Influenza, strikes the world? How does that impact higher education? What does that do for sports? What does it do for online learning? And so after February or so, people have been coming up to me, indeed asking if I'm in league with dark powers. But it's definitely something that we've been doing in the futures community for a while. And unfortunately, I don't think enough people heeded our advice and our warnings.
So what do you think? Should colleges have been better prepared for a pandemic?
I think they should have been. Especially if you look at some other nations that have had the misfortune to go through SARS or MERS, for example, Canada, those are nations that were then much more sensitive to the issue of a pandemic, and they prepared much more thoroughly and were much more ready to respond once the virus started making its way through their communities. The United States did not. And that is truly, truly unfortunate. We've had warnings in even popular entertainment. The 2012 movie Contagion, for example, is, mm-hmm. Is an excellent depiction of what could happen. And it's kind of eerie to see right now some of the echoes between that. But no, we didn't plan. We did not take enough preparation, and we really should have.
Frederick, bringing students back on campus and expecting them to follow guidelines and avoid partying, that's proving to be an uphill battle at this point. How do you think campus leaders can best manage that?
It is proving to be an uphill battle, and I have to say, not an unexpected one. These are overwhelmingly 18 to 22-year-olds. We bring them back to campuses precisely so that they do not social distance. We've been doing this for hundreds of years, in fact, thousands, if you think about ancient academies. This is how higher education operates. So we're really going against the grain, and it's going to take a lot more effort on the part not only of the students to abide by these rules, but also the institutions themselves have to find ways to enable students to have rich and vibrant and meaningful social lives that are safe. So to a certain extent, I think the schools that have turned just to discipline as a way of doing this are missing the mark. You have never in the history of higher education been able to discipline a large group of students into compliance. You need buy-in from the students. You need them to understand, and you need them to feel like this is something that can be made to work and work in a safe, but also in a fulfilling way.
Brian writes on Facebook and says, I work for university events and am enrolled as an undergrad student at Central Michigan University studying meteorology. With COVID, there are just flat out no events. At this time, I would normally be working in the sound booth for a sports event or the lights for a special speaker. Now, nothing. I relied on that income to help minimize my student loans and refund what I possibly could in hopes of being able to finally pull myself out of lower class life. Lila, does that square with some of the things that you're hearing on campus?
Sure. I would definitely say students have, you know, if they were working on campus employment before, that ability, depending on what they did, has been minimized, you know, for those who can do that sort of work from home. Some have been able to do that. And universities are going through, many universities are going through, you know, very major budget cuts. So the pain isn't only for students. You know, we've seen layoffs of staff and faculty as well. So there's a lot of pain to go around.
We've got to take a pause in about a minute, but Brian, I'm wondering if you can just lay out for us some things that schools need right now to stay afloat. Is it more enrollment? Is it more state and federal funding?
It depends on the institution. Public institutions, of which that's about two-thirds of American higher ed, they need more public funding, so they need more state funding, which is difficult since states are experiencing a shortfall. They could use more federal funding, mm-hmm. which is difficult because of a political shortfall in D.C., public universities as well as private institutions definitely need more enrollment. And that's very challenging because of the pandemic. On the one hand, the campuses that are physically open for face-to-face instruction might frighten people who see them as unsafe. And stories about rising amounts of infections on open campuses right now will add to that fear. Yeah. Campuses that are teaching online, on the other hand, are much safer, of course. But some people may be worried about a lower quality of experience. So again, it's possible that enrollment may decline overall. I think in many ways, campuses may also need investment from nonprofits such as foundations, and they may need more investment from philanthropists.
Let's take a pause here. Coming up, how will the pandemic affect the rising cost of a degree? My guests are Brian Alexander, Frederick Lawrence, and Lila Burke. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. This is 1A.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
I'm Lisa Hagen.
And I'm Chris Haxel. We're the hosts of No Compromise, NPR's new podcast exploring one family's mission to reconstruct America using two powerful tools, guns and Facebook.
New episodes drop every Tuesday. Join us for the No Compromise podcast from NPR.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We're talking about how colleges and universities are planning for the current school year and beyond with my guests, Phi Beta Kappa CEO Frederick Lawrence, education futurist Brian Alexander, and Inside Higher Ed reporter Lila Burke. And here's a comment we got from Sarah on Facebook. She says, I am the sole parent of a special needs son. I've wanted to finish my degree for years, but I cannot juggle being on campus with his medical appointments, school, and my work. This new world of online learning is great for me. I'm now enrolling for winter and couldn't be happier. Frederick, what trends were we seeing when it came to college enrollment before the pandemic? Because as we have this conversation, we're probably picturing these sprawling universities offering these four-year degrees, but there was a shift away from that type of higher education, no?
You bet. For many people, that it's still the model of the four-year experience, 18 to 22 years old. But increasingly, it's students coming back after a first experience, whether it's the military, starting a family, work career, and then trying to get a degree in public universities and community colleges, which are a major part of the higher education ecosystem. All of these are ways in which new people are coming into the system, so that's sort of one big trend. The other is that the pressure on tuition dollars has been a real flashpoint from both sides. Schools have had to rely increasingly on tuition dollars because endowment returns are down in a very troubling financial market. I mean, the market's been running up recently, but there's great uncertainty in it. Philanthropy is challenged at this time. And of course, public funding is down in virtually every state for public education. So that requires schools, except for the handful that are extremely well endowed, to really look to tuition income. That means the schools need the tuition income, individuals are pressed to be able to do that, and that's where you've got yourself a pressure point. You know, there's a lot of talk about the big endowment schools, but I think it's just worth noting the median endowment of the 4,000 plus colleges and universities in this country is about $10 million. That throws off about $500,000 a year at a 5% draw rate. A school that had 1,000 students, and most have many, many, many more than that, that would be $500 per student. That's a rounding error. That means for almost half of the schools in this country, the tuition is entirely what they rely on.
Frederick, do you think there's any truth to this email we got from Chris? He says, look at the enormous amount of construction done on campuses in recent decades. Colleges have become conduits from their customers, aka students' pocketbooks, to the banks financing their capital improvement budget.
I think it's certainly true of some schools. I think, you know, there's a salience problem here. The schools that have the biggest growth projects are the ones that catch our attention. I think the vast majority of schools, that's not the case. What they're trying to do is to make the numbers work and provide the best education they can under very challenging economic circumstances.
Lila, at the top of the show, we cited a Pew survey that showed that a majority of Americans, 61%, think that higher education is headed in the wrong direction. Does this pandemic make a stronger case for attending community colleges and trade schools?
I think that's hard to say, and it really depends on a student and what they are looking for. But we are definitely seeing more students talking about the value of higher education if, you know, they had something in mind, like a residential experience, and that's not what they're going to get. And there's also been a lot of talk among students about how much they're paying for, you know, the online experience, and they feel they should be paying less. What we know about the workforce right now is that it's very expensive to get a bachelor's degree. In many cases, it's also very expensive throughout your life not to have one. So it's really depends on the student. Community colleges are going through their own problems right now.
Yeah.
Hard to say.
Brian, what types of colleges will struggle the most as a result of the pandemic?
Well, if I can agree with my two panelists here, quite a few of the ones that will struggle are the ones that were already struggling for reasons that preceded the pandemic. We have demographic challenges, for example, in particular in the Midwest and the Northeast, where, by the way, we have more higher education per capita. So they're already suffering from enrollment pressures, and I fear that they will be already weaker than others. I think some that are not able to pivot to supply enough instruction and curriculum in COVID-19 related areas. So you think about the full spectrum of allied health, everything from surgery to nursing to anesthesiology, as well as to mental health and perhaps business and poli-sci to help in the recovery. I think campuses that can provide those are going to be winning quite a bit more foot traffic than those that cannot. It's possible that some rural colleges and universities will experience a bit more enrollment for the first time in a generation, simply because people want to get out of cities, which they perceive as hot zones. I'm not sure. I haven't seen evidence for that, but that's possible. As my colleagues have noted, the campuses that have lavish endowments are just a handful on the face of higher education. I mean, keep in mind, we have more than 4,000 colleges and universities across the U.S. Mm-hmm. There's an incredible diversity for this. I do think that the ones that can make the case that their face-to-face experience is safe will have a better chance of attracting more and more students. No, this is a question of perception and attitude, not necessarily the case of reality. The ones that are having a bad time with a reputation, with having high numbers of cases, such as, you know, the University of Alabama, for example, or certain schools in Georgia, I think will be suffering. Those that can make a case for themselves of providing high-quality online education, those that have a good brand for that or have other ways of making that case, I think will be better off.
Right.
I do think that it's possible that we'll see the ones that also make a name for themselves in terms of research and development for the pandemic. So you think about the University of Washington, Seattle, for example, which did some great work. Or, of course, Johns Hopkins University, which is, you know, famous for providing the most popular dashboard on the pandemic overall. So I think all of those have a good chance. There is one extra problem, though, and that is international students. American higher education has relied heavily on international students for about the past 20, 25 years.
Right.
The number of international students has increased. And one of the reasons we rely on them is they tend to be the ones that pay full top dollar, full price. That inflow of students has gone down for the past couple of years, partly due to perceptions of the Trump administration, partly due to perceptions of school shootings. But of course, with the pandemic and travel blocking, that's all really up in the air. On top of that, we have the geopolitical struggle between the United States and China. China has supplied the United States with more graduate students than any other, more international students than any other country. So it's possible we'll see a downward turn in international students coming to American higher education, which is going to hit us financially. It's going to hit us in terms of diversity. And I would say campuses that depend on that population are especially fragile right now.
Well, Frederick, Brian brings up a great point. You know, can you talk to us a bit more about students with visas? How has the pandemic changed the way that international students are feeling about attending school here? And what's the financial impact of all this for them?
It's a very substantial financial impact. Before all this happened, about 5% of the students in all of our colleges and universities were international students. But at many of our schools, that percentage was much higher. And as Brian correctly points out, those students are overwhelmingly full-pay students, which means they are responsible for far more than that of the net tuition revenue. If you take those students out of the equation, then a lot of schools are going to be struggling to continue the model they've had, which is using that tuition dollar revenue stream from international students to help pay for the financial aid for domestic students so that they're not paying full freight. You know, when people ask what the cost of higher education is, when I was president of Brandeis and IBS, what's the tuition? I'd always say, I'll answer that question in a second. But first, I got to tell you that only one third of my students are paying that number. Two thirds are on some kind of financial aid, and some of them quite substantial financial aid. But where are those resources going to come from? Some comes from endowment, the rest has to come from other sources of tuition. So when those international students come out of the equation, you really do have this this enormous challenge. By the way, those students are not only paying full freight, but they're paying out-of-state tuition at state universities, so they were particularly valuable for state universities. So both public and private universities are going to be challenged by this. And if you want to know how important those students are, watch what's happened in the universities in Canada, in New Zealand, in Australia, in the UK, where they have actively recruited those international students, and very effectively so.
Lisa emailed us and says, my daughter attends the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. School leadership has been consistent in their messaging and diligent in enforcing safe practices with mandated mask wearing. College students should be held to account like everyone else. They can see friends, just do it safely. And then we got a message from Nicholas, who actually disagrees. He says, try to get students to not socialize? Get serious. Have you tried to herd cats? Lila, I'm looking at you here, you know, because traditionally, students tend to be at the forefront of protests and political activism on campus. But what does that look like during the current wave of racial and social tensions when many students aren't even on campus and the ones that are being asked not to gather?
Sure. So I would say the sort of disjointed nature of students, the student body right now, you know, with not every student on campus, I think, you know, going coming out of this summer, we potentially, you know, if every student was on campus, we would see more activism. I think that's fair to say. But students and graduate students are finding their own ways to get their voices heard, you know, through online, through open letters, things like that, even when they can't gather and shout together. We're also seeing, I would say, a bit of, you know, from graduate students, I would say we're seeing a bit of increased, you know, militancy that's really been focused at their institutions and their administrations. Graduate students at the University of Michigan went on strike this week to protest what they see as, you know, an inadequate testing regimen, a lack of transparency from the administration, and also about some, you know, anti-policing, anti-ICE demands. Mm-hmm. So in that realm, we're definitely seeing a sort of increased militancy.
Well, Frederick, you touched on this earlier, which was financial aid, because one of the biggest deciding factors, let's be real here, for prospective college students is affordability. In the light of this pandemic, colleges have, some have, committed to online instruction this semester and offering discounts to tuition. Can you tell us, 30 seconds before we take a pause, but give us a quick rundown about the types of schools that are cutting rates right now?
Well, the problem with the schools that are cutting rates, by and large, are the schools that have a sufficient endowment to support that, because what they're trying to do is to get from here to there till the end of the year. The problem is that we're in a very dangerous part of the economic model where it's costing universities and colleges more to produce a product, if you will, that is less appreciated and less valuable. It costs money in testing, it costs money in resources to train people, to provide places for them to live. And yet the education is online. So it's a disconnect right now.
And we'll pick that up once we return. We're discussing the future of higher education with the CEO of Phi Beta Kappa, Frederick Lawrence, author of Academia Next, Brian Alexander, and Inside Higher Ed reporter, Lila Burke. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as isolation, depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment when you need professional help. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
I'm Guy Raz, and on NPR's How I Built This, how Mike Radenbaugh slapped a battery and a motor on his bike so he could get to school faster and went on to build the biggest electric bike brand in the U.S., Rad Power Bikes. Subscribe or listen now.
Now let's get back to our conversation about the future of higher education. My guests are Frederick Lawrence, the CEO of Phi Beta Kappa and a distinguished lecturer at Georgetown Law Center. Brian Alexander is an education futurist and author of Academia Next. And Lila Burke is a reporter at Inside Higher Ed. Frederick, I want to give you a chance to pick up where you left off. We were talking about colleges that have been offering tuition discounts, given what's going on. Tell us more about the impact on their bottom line here when they're cutting these rates.
You know, we've been talking about the possible reduction in number of colleges. And by the way, I would never question the prognostication abilities of somebody who called a pandemic 2 years ago. So Brian's okay in my book if he says 10%. That's about the number I probably would have guessed, too.
Right.
But I think it actually combines two different things that are going on. One is schools that are actually financially challenged, whose models no longer work. They've been borrowing to try to stay ahead, using borrowed funds for operating expenses, watching foundation contributions go down, watching tuition numbers go down. Those schools probably were stressed coming into this, and they may not make it out of this. And those probably, in the natural course of things, those should evolve out or be consolidated into other schools. Then there are schools that have to be able to survive this year coming to get by, and then they'll be okay. But if they can't survive this year coming, then they may not make it. And they may not make it in either of two ways. They may literally not make it. They may go out of business because they can't make their cost structure. Or in order to make their cost structure, they have to start laying off large numbers of staff. They have to start laying off or furloughing faculty. And the problem with higher education, as opposed to a lot of other sectors, is once you put the nose of the plane down, you can't always pull out of that dive. So when you take away tuition income, which, as I said earlier, is where most of the tuition, most of the income from most of our colleges and universities comes from, then there's no place to hide. It can only come from government funding. Mm-hmm. It can come from philanthropy, which can only fill so much. So I am concerned that those discounts are a wealthy school's game to be able to keep their faculty around and keep their students happy. Most schools can't afford to play that game.
Ming tweets us and says, what about courses at universities that require in-person labs, neuroscience, biology, chemistry, etc.? Stephen, along the same lines, he writes to us on Facebook and says, I could see in the future classes going the way online TV has gone. You can pick your packages and add-ons, maybe even to the point where you can pick which professor you want to take, say math 101 or economics from. Brian, will online learning become significantly more popular? Are these folks right?
It is already more popular. I mean, we need to go back to March and April and just recognize what an extraordinary event happened, which is that higher education, which is often seen as extremely slow, conservative, hard to change, rapidly flung its entire education apparatus online in a matter of weeks, if not just a couple of days, which is just really, truly astonishing. And some of the people who were heroic in that, instructional designers, academic technologists, and of course, faculty, just really need to be recognized for that. So we already have that experience. We just goosed up the number of students who are taking online classes and the number of faculty who are teaching them, as well as the staff who support them. I think this is simply going to increase as universities overall get better at offering them, as we get more and more faculty get to learn from the mm-hmm. decades of experience and research done on this topic. Now, one wild card here is what happens to price. There's a lot of pressure coming in all directions on higher education to reduce price. As my colleague just said, that's something that rich mm-hmm. institutions can afford to do, but most can't. So there's a real question. Will we see a downward pressure on published tuition?
Yeah.
But it may be that some decide to take online learning because they just simply see it's cheaper.
Abigail says via email, she says, I'm a PhD student and I'm also a research assistant and instructor for my university. The perpetual underpayment of graduate labor, which is what I am, and the limited job market don't appear to be getting any better anytime soon. I love being a teacher and scholar. I care deeply about my students and strive to make a positive impact on them as students and humans. But the chronic underfunding of higher ed is demoralizing. Lila, how are the employees of colleges and universities adjusting to all of this?
I would say it's been hard for everyone. It's been hard for faculty who are not used to teaching online to teach online. It's been hard for faculty who are not used to teaching behind several layers of plexiglass to do something like that. And then in addition, you know, we have the layoffs, the furloughs, and certainly people are upset. And I think that's, graduate students were in sort of a bind before this. You had a lot of unrest. You had a lot of unionization movements from graduate students before the pandemic. And I think that's pushing some of them to, you know, in cases where sometimes you have graduate students, you know, being asked to teach in person when faculty might be able to not have to take that risk, you know, I think that's sort of galvanizing people to reevaluate their role and what they want from their institution.
Martin in Tennessee emailed us and said, when young people find their expensive undergraduate degrees are no longer sufficient to get them a job capable of paying off their student loans, it should come as no surprise that they are questioning the value of the current education system. If COVID-19 brings about a radical restructuring of the way we prepare young people for productive lives, then I believe that will be a large silver lining in this pandemic cloud. Before we go, I want to pose this question to all of you, you know, because deciding whether to attend college, it's a very personal decision, right? And it's one that many high school seniors are struggling with, especially right now. Quick advice that you have that you would give to a high school student when considering higher education. Lila, you first.
Oh, wow. I guess, you know, it like I said before, it really depends on the student. I suppose at this point, you know, while we've been talking about these budget cuts to a student who, you know, is thinking about pursuing higher education, I would say that it's important to pay attention to what stuff like these layoffs and furloughs, you know, have done to maybe the college that you wanted to go to. You know, mm-hmm. How has that changed what it looks like, and how has that changed what your experience might be? You know, is your program as robust as maybe it would have been before this?
Yeah.
And I think those are certainly things a student might want to keep in mind.
Some brief advice, Brian?
A few things. Again, it depends on the student. One is to take a look at the individual campuses and to see if you think they're likely to be around in 5 years. I recommend using some of the tools and resources from groups like EdBit or the recent book, The College Stress Test, to just get a sense of, you know, are you likely to get a degree that will be worth less if the place goes out of business or folds into something else. A second thing is to look at how well a college or university does two things. First, how well it does online learning. And so dive into that, really, you know, sample some of the classes, get a sense of just, you know, does that work for you as a learner? And then second, if they're face-to-face, carefully analyze how well they are doing this. Look at how often they are doing tests, for example. Talk to the local town or county authorities and see what they are saying about infection rates.
And let me get Frederick in here real quick. Just 20 seconds, Frederick. What's your advice for high school students?
My advice is to be of good faith, and that with all the challenges we have, higher education is still the best investment you're going to make for a productive life, a meaningful life, and an engaged life as a citizen. And I'll tell you, I've asked thousands of alumni, mm-hmm. tell me a moment from your college education, and you know something? It never takes place in a lecture hall. It's in a faculty office, it's in a dorm room, and it's walking on campus. That's where lives get changed, and that's still going to happen when we get to the other side of this.
Frederick Lawrence is the CEO of Phi Beta Kappa and a distinguished lecturer at Georgetown Law Center. Brian Alexander is an education futurist and author of Academia Next. And Lila Burke is a reporter at Inside Higher Ed. Thank you all for your expertise today. This conversation was produced by Sharla Freeland and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.